Back in 2016, Jerry Kolb and Michael Dorff published one of the most thought-provoking books in the animal rights world. It is called Beating Hearts, and it attempts to resolve a challenging question. How can you condemn hunting, animal farming, and animal experimentation while also favoring legal abortion, which is the deliberate destruction of a human fetus? If you are someone like me, who thinks abortion should be legal, but goes as far as not to even kill mosquitoes, then this issue hits home. But more than that, this book is the proof that the secular vegan philosophy and intellectual tradition has enough depth to tackle and appropriate itself some of the most complex and sensitive moral hot-button issues of our time. To discuss the book, I have the honor to welcome the author himself, Michael Dorff, a Robert S. Stevens Professor of Law at Cornell University and longtime animal rights activist. Check out the episode notes for more details. And if you appreciate this conversation and my independent reporting of the animal rights world, then please share this episode with your fellow vegans.
You had asked me before we started recording to talk a little bit about Sherry Kolb, who is my co-author on this book, and who passed away in 2022. The book was published in 2016, and I thought I'd say a little bit about Sherry's work in animal rights. So first, both of us were trained as lawyers. We were colleagues for many years, but also married. We became vegans in 2006, but had been sort of moving in that direction in the way that a lot of people do over the better course of a decade, in stages. Initially, we did so as a kind of personal choice. And over time, it became woven into our respective work. I would say more initially for Sherry than for me. If I think about the sort of roots of Sherry's activism, she always loved animals. We had dogs, and she was very fond of animals as a kid. She actually is, I think I can say this, she's responsible for a line in a Supreme Court case in 1993, long before she became vegan. So when Sherry was a law clerk for Justice Harry Blackmun on the U.S. Supreme Court, there was a case before the court called Church of Lukumi Babalu I against Hialeah. And the case posed the question whether a local law that forbade ritual animal slaughter, it was targeted at practitioners of Santeria, whether that law violated freedom of religion. And the Supreme Court unanimously said, yes, the law was unconstitutional because it singled out ritual slaughter as opposed to being a kind of general purpose anti-cruelty law. Justice Blackmun wrote a concurrence saying that, well, it would be a very different case if this were a law that was going after slaughter more generally on the grounds that it was inhumane. In that case, the government would have a much stronger interest. He wrote that because Sherry pushed him to write it. And it's one of the very few expressions of what you might think of as animal welfare in the U.S. Supreme Court case law. So I think Sherry was kind of a proto-vegan already. But what sort of pushed her and therefore me into veganism and then the animal rights movement was that she was for many years colleagues with Gary Francione at the Rutgers Law School. And Gary is, of course, a well-known author and animal rights activist. He wasn't that, I would say, much of an advocate with his colleagues, I think because he didn't think there was much of a hope. But Sherry was sympathetic to him from the beginning. She started working there in 1995. And, one way you saw it was she would sometimes bake cookies for the faculty. And because she wanted to include Gary, she always made them vegan too. And that, I think, planted a seed. There was no exact turning point for the veganism, but we sort of, as I said, gradually got there in 2006. And then after we moved to Ithaca, we sort of joined the local vegan community, which included a number of very prominent people. So Colin Campbell, who's most famous for the China Study, lives in Ithaca. There's Farm Sanctuary is a 40-minute drive away in Watkins Glen. The filmmakers, James Levesque and Jenny Stein, live here. A friend of ours, Amy Hamlin, who runs something called the Coalition for Healthy School Foods, which promotes plant-based foods in public schools, lives here. So we became friends with all of these people. And one of the things they encouraged us to do was to go to something called Vegan Summerfest. At the time, it was called Vegetarian Summerfest, although it was purely vegan. And there, we were exposed to just many more people in the movement. And that led Sherry to decide she wanted to offer a class in animal rights. A lot of law schools offer classes in animal law, but her view at the time, and I think it was true for her throughout her life, was that the law was not a very powerful instrument for bringing about change for animals, mostly because it's very difficult to enforce laws that go very far beyond where people are in their own social attitudes. And so she thought that if you wanted to make real progress, you had to at least start with working on people's viewpoints. And so she taught this class in animal rights for many, many years. She brought in guest speakers, many of whom we met at Summerfest, they had a lot of various perspectives. We met lots of interesting people in the movement. And that led to Sherry's first book, which was not her first book, but her first book on animal rights, which was called Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger and Other Questions People Ask Vegans. And what that book does in 13 chapters is it poses questions that people commonly ask, like, where do you get your protein? Isn't it, if other animals eat animals, why is it wrong for humans to eat animals? These sorts of things, some of which are often posed as gotcha questions or not in good faith. But the point of her book was to take these questions seriously, to treat them, regardless of how they might be asked by any given person, as though they were being asked in good faith, and then really grapple with them. One of the questions that was posed in that book is, are you pro-life? Because that was a question we had encountered from, I think, some people who were pro-choice on abortion and wanted just sort of wanted to know, well, does your theory lead to this other position? And some who were, in fact, pro-life on abortion, but were part of the animal rights movement. So you can think of someone like Matthew Scully. I mean, he wasn't the actual person who posed that question to Sherry, but other people did. And she has a kind of the kernel of the argument that we would unpack at greater length in Beating Hearts in that chapter of Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger. In addition to the chapters in Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger, Sherry had all sorts of interesting ideas about veganism and animal rights, which she wrote about both in academic work that appears in, scholarly journals, and in more popular work. She and I, for many years, I still do this, publish a biweekly columns, first in something called Find Law, and for the last 15 years or so in a journal called Verdict. And in addition to that, I have a blog for which I write, two or three times a week, and Sherry used to write every other week. So she would explore almost, all sorts of things. She had a number of interesting essays about the relation between various religious practices and veganism. She was quite interested in how different movements responded and worked together. So she would draw parallels between the LGBTQ rights movement and animal rights. And so she, I think she sort of covered the waterfront during a period in which she was actively thinking and writing about animal rights.
Admirable. Thank you so much for sharing that about
Sure.
Sherry. And I'm impatient to get into the topic of the book, Beating Hearts. But first, I want to have maybe your opinion, as a lawyer and as a professor of law, about the expression, the term animal rights. I'm meeting more and more activists in the animal rights, animal liberation space who are taking their distance away from that expression and who would rather prefer to use vegan or veganism instead of talking about animal rights. Because they feel, it's a bit too much detached from the reality of people, and that maybe there's, like you said, no future in advancing the animal cause on the legal front. What do you make of that and of the term, animal rights?
Yeah, so I want to answer that question in a second, but first I want to just clarify. I don't think there's no future in advancing the cause of animals through the law. I think that I would qualify that in two ways. So the contention, which was Sherry's, but I largely share this, is that it will be difficult to make a whole lot of progress now through laws that do what we really want them to do, because to get those enacted, you would need much more support than they currently have. But I think there are at least two ways in which law can be useful. One is we can think long term that, eventually, once people's hearts and minds have been changed, it might be possible to enact laws that do have sort of serious teeth. And the second is that, I don't think of legal reform, whether through legislation, referenda, or court cases, as operating separate from social and political activism, so that litigation or a campaign for legal change can be a kind of social activism, so that even if what you're seeking is relatively modest, getting rid of battery cages, for example, or as in the case of the litigation, you're just trying to have these particular elephants moved to a sanctuary rather than kept in a zoo or another form of captivity. And even if you fail, the campaign itself can move the needle by changing people's minds and therefore laying the foundation for further change. So I'd just say that about the law. Coming directly to your question, I don't have a strong view about the nomenclature. Until very recently, for a while now, I've heard people not want to use the word vegan because they fear that it turns people off. I don't love the term plant-based only because it's misleading. My friend and fellow activist Victoria Moran likes to use the term plant exclusive rather than plant-based because it's more accurate. Because I've seen products labeled plant-based that contain some animal products. It's like, well, the base is plants. It's then the additional thing. So I think any term one uses, whether it's vegan, animal rights, plant-based, or something else, is going to potentially have two problems. One is that it might not be exactly accurate in capturing everything that the people who want to use it want to project through the term. And the other is words can take on a kind of guilt by association, so that if there are negative attitudes towards a term, even if it's inherently unproblematic, there might be tactical or strategic reasons to move away from it. You see this sometimes moving outside of this particular realm. You see this sometimes with the way in which the preferred term for a group that suffers some form of systemic discrimination or subordination will want to change the name because a stigma becomes associated with the term. Even though the term is not inherently offensive, it becomes offensive because a lot of the people who are using it at a particular time have discriminatory attitudes about it. And so that might be some of what's going on with animal rights versus something else. My own preference would be to use whatever term is going to be most effective at building support for the shared goals of the movement.
Okay, let's get to the book now. I before reading your book, I have to say I never really thought a lot about abortion and the debate, pro-choice, pro-life. I live in Canada, I live in Quebec. This is not part of the political culture here to debate this. And so I never, this was never top of mind, not like in America. But I always got, the impression that this was very, this rattles people and, triggers, lots of, reactions. So I guess my first question about the book is, did you have, conversations about maybe hesitations about not publishing the book in fear of the kind of reception you would get from publishing this book touching to this third rail issue, and also what kind of reception did you get once you published the book?
So the short answer is no, not really. I mean, we're both academics, and I think we consider ourselves activists, but we're careful in our scholarly work to make claims that are backed by good arguments and good citations and what have you. And that sometimes will lead me, and this was true of Sherry as well, to take positions that might not be especially popular with our friends as well as with people with whom we more often disagree. So we didn't really worry too much about that. I had written about abortion in my scholarly work, as had Sherry in a lot of different articles and so forth. And I think that no one who knew us would be surprised that this was an issue we were discussing. We did have a worry a little bit about whether it made sense as a kind of tactical matter if we were thinking of ourselves as advocates for animals or advocates for whatever position we're going to be proposing on abortion to combine the two, because it's a little bit like you take a controversial subject and you what you normally the way you want to persuade somebody of your view is to find an area of agreement and then show how their agreement on X means that they should also agree with you on Y. Here we're taking Y and saying, well, here's something else you don't agree with us on potentially. And so that seems kind of backwards as an advocacy strategy. But I have to say, we really didn't think about it as advocacy. As far as the reception goes, I think it was generally quite positive. I have two caveats about that. One is we went back and forth with the publisher over the cover illustration, because the cover illustration includes a human baby, not like a fetus or an embryo. And I think that led some people who didn't read the book to think that this was a sort of strongly anti-abortion book, which it is not. And so I actually had one conversation with somebody who had that view, and I tried to, explain to her, no, that's not what's going on there. But the marketing people persuaded us that this was better than any of the ideas we came up with for cover illustrations. I would say that people who are sort of whose first commitment is to animals, and like you might have thought about the abortion issue, might have some position about it, but it's not something that is sort of an animating issue for them, really liked the book. They thought, oh, this is interesting. You're shedding interesting light back and forth. For people who came to the book with, I think, strong views about abortion, if they were pro-choice, I think they were initially a little bit put off, but then generally came around and sort of liked our arguments. And I think the opposite is true of people who are pro-life. That is, I think people who are pro-life, there were a few who I thought took who said, and I appreciated this, well, I don't agree with you, but at least you're giving our argument, you're taking our argument seriously, and you're not responding to a straw man version of it. And you know, that to me is about what I would expect. I didn't expect that we would persuade anybody who was strongly opposed to abortion to change their view about that from this book. But it was our hope that we would sort of feel the force of arguments on all sides of the respective issues. I should say the all sides. I actually don't think there are any very good arguments against the animal rights position. So I'm open to feeling the force of contrary arguments. I just didn't see any here. I don't find I tend to find that people who are opposed to the kind, you know, sort of minimal rights for animals are engaged in rationalization rather than, you know, building serious arguments.
I agree with what that person said about the straw man argument. I really feel like in your book, you're making the best pro-choice argument because you are addressing the real arguments coming from the pro-life people. You know, you take them seriously, yes, but you, what's most important is you represent their argument well. And I really realized, you know, from reading the book that I had been fed a caricature version of what was a pro-life person. I really had, and that's the best word for it, a caricature in my head of, you know, who, like in the beginning of your book, you talk about how most pro-life people are pro-life for religious reason and they have nothing to do with, you know, they have not thought about the question of sentience. And that's what I had in my mind, you know, someone like deeply religious or fanatic who hates women. And that's what, you know, gets you to believe that pro-life is a good stance. But yeah, you really represented well. We should clarify, what is your position on abortion?
So the view that Sherry and I defend in the book is that abortions before fetal sentience, which is that you can, there is a range of legitimate scientific argument about when exactly fetuses attain sentience, but it's certainly well past the point at which about 90% of abortions in North America occur. But our view is that abortions before fetal sentience do not raise serious moral questions. Abortions after fetal sentience do raise serious moral questions, and that therefore someone deciding whether to have an abortion of a sentient fetus, first of all, has a kind of moral duty to try to make that decision before fetal sentience, but you can't always. Sometimes there are circumstances that arise late in pregnancy. But that there is a kind of personal moral duty to give serious weight to the fetus's interest if one is going to have an abortion after fetal sentience. But that still doesn't answer the question of what position the law ought to take on abortion, because there are many areas of life where one has a moral duty to take seriously some matter. But if one takes it seriously, or even if one doesn't take it seriously and makes a kind of moral mistake, we don't necessarily think that justifies the state in intervening. So our view is that in general, abortion up until fairly late in pregnancy ought to be legal, but that people ought to take seriously their moral duties with respect to abortion of sentient fetuses.
So when you say sentience, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so sentience is The ability to have and the having of subjective experiences such as pleasure, pain, excitement, thoughts, etc. It's the difference between something and someone. It's a sort of a first person subjective consciousness. It's a synonym for rough synonym for consciousness. The reason I prefer the term sentience, although maybe I shouldn't, because a lot of people who aren't in the animal movement don't know the word, but the reason I prefer sentience is that consciousness, I think, tends to signify more of a kind of rational thought process. And a being need not be rational in the way that, we think of like a, a philosophy professor, in order to be sentient. So, it's basically what distinguishes most animal life from, just about all plants, as far as we are aware, all plant life and inanimate objects.
Okay, so you mentioned how sentience is, yes, a very well-known popular word used in the animal rights world. How did you tie this term of sentience to, what is the link between that to, abortion? Or since we're talking about abortion, how did you tie that, concept of sentience to, talking about the fittest to animals.
Sure. So the first thing to note, right, is that this is the using sentience as the basis for rights is hardly something we came up with, right? This is a common view among people who support animal rights, and it goes back quite far. If you think about, Jeremy Bentham's famous line, the question is not can they think, but can they suffer, right? And it's a little weird to think about animal rights and then talk about Bentham because Bentham was a utilitarian who famously derided the whole idea of rights as nonsense on stilts. But nonetheless, Peter Singer is also a utilitarian and he's associated with the animal rights movement as well. And right, so the idea is that, beings who are capable of suffering should not be unnecessarily made to suffer. That's the sort of, I think, the core of the animal rights idea. It's also, you can find it in many religions. It's, I think, the most clearly in the idea of ahimsa in the Indian religions. It doesn't have to be a religious idea. It could just simply be, if there's any kind of moral principle, it's you shouldn't unnecessarily inflict suffering on a being capable of suffering. And this takes an additional logical step, which we can talk about later. Likewise, a being capable of experiencing pleasure or pleasurable experiences or deriving something positive out of its life shouldn't be deprived of its life either. And both of those principles, I think, are in play, not only with respect to the duties we humans owe to animals, but also with respect to whatever duties we owe to human fetuses. After all, a human fetus that is capable of experiencing pain or is capable of, having subjective experiences more generally, seems to have the same kinds of interests in both avoiding the painful experience and in continuing to exist as would a non-human animal like a chicken or a pig or what have you. So it seemed to us just quite logical that these ought to be connected. And we also noticed that a lot of the pro-life advocacy that aims at people sort of in the middle, that is to say, not people who have strong religious commitments that they believe in the ensoulment of a zygote, but people who, just are sort of don't think about it much, that a lot of the argument aimed at them works in this register of avoiding inflicting suffering. So one of the things that we saw in the United States over the course of several decades were campaigns to enact laws and also to public information campaigns about fetal pain. Right. So there's legislation in various U.S. states. There's a bill introduced in the National Congress to ban, quote, pain-capable abortions. That is to say, abortions of fetuses capable of experiencing pain. And I think that reflected a recognition that at least for a lot of the audience for the debate about abortion, people cared about abortion or didn't care about abortion, whether or not they imagined the infliction of pain or other suffering on a fetus, right? And so that it does seem to us that putting aside distinctly religious views, the secular argument against abortion looks very much like the argument for respecting animals.
If I had to summarize what you just said, you looked at people who cared about, fetus abortions, all of that, since we are humans, since they are Americans, and you explain why they care about it by talking about sentience. And then you tie it to the animal rights movement for them. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, so I think that's right, with the possible exception of that. I don't know that that's why all of them care about it. I'm sure that's not why all of them care about it. As you were saying, and many people might hold these views simply because that's what their religion tells them. But I think that it's certainly true that some of them have this view for that reason. And certainly you see it in the kinds of arguments that they make. And so again, much like Sherry's book on Mind If I Order the Cheeseburger, right? The goal here is to take this seriously and respond to what is sometimes called the steel man, right, as opposed to the straw man version of the argument.
By the way, I should say that here in Quebec, abortion is legal up until 9 months. So, kind of a strange situation. What do you make of those people, and you touch on that in the book, who believe that humans are special, our own kind? It is they justify it, their views with religion. And so, yeah, humans are special, they are unique, and we should not, mix that with the rest of the animal kingdom. Basically, going against what Darwin was saying about humans and the rest of animals, there's a difference of degrees and not of nature. Well, those people say there's a difference of nature. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that if somebody is asserting that as a matter of, religious doctrine, there are really two kinds of responses one can make. One is somebody who falls within the same religious tradition, I think can usually point to resources within that religious tradition for why this is a mistake. So that in just about every religious tradition, there are resources for showing kindness to animals. It's very, very clear in the Eastern religions, especially those that believe in reincarnation and the possibility that one's soul could have come from or end up in a non-human animal. It's within the Christian tradition, the reason, the current Pope, Pope Francis, right, took his name from Francis of Assisi, who is known for his kindness to animals. In both Judaism and Islam, the rules around slaughter of animals both permit slaughter of animals, but both kosher laws and halal are thought to be partly about reducing cruelty to animals. And so, even if one begins with a sort of strongly religious basis for one's morality, that's not a reason to unnecessarily harm animals. In fact, it's the opposite, right? So that's one kind of an argument within that area. And then one can say, look, we're not saying that necessarily that non-human animals are the same as humans in all respects, and maybe not even in what you think of as the most important respect, but just in one respect that you care about. And so the same sort of compassionate motives you might have for being against abortion can apply to not participating in various forms of animal exploitation. The other thing one can do, and this I think is going to be more or less effective depending on one's audience, is to say something like, well, look, we live in a religiously diverse society in which people come from a variety of faiths or no faith at all. And so if we're going to have a public debate, we have to restrict ourselves to what John Rawls called public reason. And that means particularly sectarian arguments are out of bounds, at least as a basis for public regulation. Although, of course, they could be a basis for particulars' individual moral choices. And so therefore, let's bracket those. If I can, I want to draw one analogy, which is, I think that some of what you're talking about, right, the idea that it's almost offensive from a religious person's perspective to be talking about the rights of fetuses in the same breath as the rights of chickens or cows or pigs, I think that is a kind of reaction that one sometimes sees in other forms of animal advocacy that compare the treatment of non-human animals to historic injustices against human beings, like slavery or the Holocaust or what have you. And I understand why, as a tactical matter, therefore, one should be very careful about drawing such analogies. But I think the people who are taking offense are misunderstanding the way in which the argument is being made, right? If somebody says that what's happening to animals on farms and slaughterhouses is comparable to slavery or the Holocaust, they're not trying to minimize slavery or the Holocaust. They're not trying to say that people who were enslaved or people who were victims of genocide were, as worthless as animals. It's because the people making this comparison think of non-human animals as having great worth that we think of it as comparable. To my mind, there is at best a tactical reason to avoid drawing these sorts of analogies, because it's not effective advocacy to offend people, even if people, ideally shouldn't be offended by the argument you're making.
I agree that you don't want to start a conversation. Well, it's difficult to have a conversation if you start with something judged offensive. But at the same time, don't you want to get personal right away with people and, get at the heart of it? And the best way to do it is really to touch on some issues such as abortion. I guess my question is, if done in a thoughtful manner, shouldn't more activists not shy away from addressing, doing your argument, the argument you're making in the book, and talking about abortion, or discussing, the Holocaust as it is done in the book, An Eternal Treblinka, because they would catch the attention of people much more quickly and get them to think maybe more profoundly on those issues. Or is it a miscalculation on my part?
Yeah, so I don't think there's a lot of research now being done by people in the animal rights movement about what kinds of advocacy are most effective. One thing we learn is that something I wouldn't have thought turns out to be true, which is that showing people really graphic imagery of, what happens in a slaughterhouse, is pretty effective, at least in the short run. At sort of shocking people. And I've looked at that data and I have to confess, I think it's right that that probably does work. I don't know that there has been similar research backing up the kinds of what people think of as provocative analogies. There was a case about a decade ago in Germany in which the German branch of PETA had these billboards that said "Holocaust on your plate," and they were actually prosecuted under, because in Germany has very strict laws about Nazism and so forth. And of course, it was a complete misunderstanding of what PETA was trying to do, but it might not have been very effective advocacy for PETA in Germany then. So I don't think that there is a definite answer to your question at this point. I think some people are going to find that kind of advocacy more effective or less effective with particular audiences. Certainly one wants to reach people at a personal level. And one way to do that is to find some personal connection. It could be through an issue that your interlocutor cares about, if that's abortion, for example, but it could be through something that, some other shared view, like, a person who has a companion animal, like a dog or a cat, will almost invariably, sympathize and empathize with dogs and cats. And so that's often a gateway in. Now, how far it gets you is not entirely clear. But again, this is an area that I haven't studied directly, but I have seen some of the studies, and I think they're somewhat inconclusive. But there's an emerging picture, and I would urge any advocate who's comfortable in adopting a variety of tactics to look at the data we have and sort of see what they think they can be most effective doing.
Yeah, I think that's what's lacking, the desire to even explore that, because I guess even activists putting themselves out there don't want to be in that discomfort, this very, uncomfortable situation of having to talk about abortion or drawing parallels with the Holocaust. Like, I would understand that, how distasteful it sounds for certain activists or volunteers to organizations to go there and.
Right. No. So again, I'm sometimes when I'm asked this kind of a question, and I've done presentations on effective advocacy, in which I sort of try to summarize what the latest data say, is I sometimes end by telling people, in the end, you don't really need to worry about it too much because, like any movement, the animal rights, animal protection, animal welfare movement has a very wide array of people with both with respect to what they think the goal is and with respect to what they think the means of achieving that goal are. And so it's not like there's some central command that's now telling all the activists, okay, this is the way we're going to make our arguments. So people will end up doing a variety of things. I guess I don't know that drawing these analogies is necessarily helpful, but if someone's comfortable doing it and they think it's going to be effective, that will be a reason to go ahead. I should say that, again, we didn't write that book because we thought that bringing up abortion was an especially effective means of advocating for the rights of animals. I think we did have in mind that some people who had an interest in the abortion issue would read our book, and they might or might not come away convinced about anything we said about abortion. But might in the process have learned something about the treatment of animals, and that might affect how they thought and behaved with respect to animals. But it was not primarily conceived of as a way of leveraging the abortion issue to make a bunch of points about animals.
Certainly not. And yeah, I guess my point is, it's in your arsenal. Those, beating hearts exist, dominion exists, and there are. This is part of your arsenal as an activist, and you should be aware of that because I have now mentioned your book to many people, and
Thank you.
of course, and it surprises me how. There are, street activists who have done this for the last 10 years who have not read Beating Hearts. And yeah, it's like it's in your arsenal. You should know the argument about abortions and yeah. Okay. Now you mentioned that how, the footage of animals being slaughtered was effective. In getting people interested in the cause and in becoming vegans. Now, it is also a strategy used by pro-life people. And this is my favorite part in the book, how you draw those parallels between pro-life activists and animal rights activists. And I would love if you go if you could, draw some more of those parallels and talk about why is it important to explore that.
Sure. So, just for those for people who haven't read the book or aren't familiar with it, it's divided into two parts, what I would call sort of philosophy, which is the first 60% of the book, and then sort of strategy, which is the remaining 40% or so of the book. And so the philosophy part is all about, how do you reconcile various views about abortion with views about animal rights, what's the relevance or irrelevance of belonging to the human family as opposed to some other species. But then we turn in the back half of the book to noting ways in which the sort of there are similar advocacy challenges for both the pro-life and animal rights movement. And that's a switch because for the most part, in the first part of the book, we are, although we analogize at first the pro-life position to the animal rights position, we end up ultimately inverting that and defending a pretty conventional pro-choice view, and reconciling that with animal rights. But the parallels, in tactics, do correspond with pro-life movement and the animal rights movement. And there are two main ones that I would focus on, one of which is the one you mentioned, which is it is, notoriously true that the anti-abortion movement will, in various circumstances, either hold up or otherwise display or publicize pictures of aborted fetuses. And these are meant to be very disturbing images. And likewise, some people in the animal rights movement will either hold up pictures or try to get people to watch videos of what happens to animals during slaughter and other processes. Couple of things I would say. So first, one of the problematic aspects of the way in which that is leveraged by the anti-abortion movement is those are typically pictures of late-term abortions, but the movement aims to ban abortion from the very beginning of pregnancy. And so there's a bit of dishonesty, I think, in that it's not, I think those images would be appropriate as a mean as a kind part of an argument for addressing late-term abortion, but less so for the sort of broad ban on abortion. And I don't think that's true of the footage with respect to animals. Second thing I want to say about images is there is, I think, a kind of prima facie moral question, right? Which is that people are going about their business and they've got, everyone's got complicated lives, they've got their own challenges. And then as an activist, you confront them with something extremely upsetting. And you're doing harm when you do that. And so I think you have to have a good reason to do that kind of harm. You know, in the same way that I think it's wrong to unnecessarily harm non-human animals. Well, humans are animals too. If I'm harming a human by upsetting them, then I need a good reason to do that. So the good reason has to be, well, they are participating in a very harmful activity themselves. And I'm hoping that by doing them this short-term harm, I'm going to change their mind and thus change their behavior. So, but there is that kind of a sort of moral calculus there. And I think that that's a, you know, something that you have to take seriously. Again, the data I know of about the efficacy of showing people graphic imagery postdates when we wrote that book. So I think if I were to revisit that chapter today, I would come down more firmly in favor of saying, yeah, this is something that it's fine to do, not because you're not doing harm to people by upsetting them, but because it's more justified because it's efficacious, right? The fact that you have a noble cause isn't a sufficient reason. It's got to be that you have a noble cause and it's likely to have some sort of an impact. So that's with respect to images. I can stop there and ask if you have follow-up questions about that, or I can talk a little bit about violence if you want.
No, please go ahead with violence.
Okay. So the other parallel is the question of what role, if any, violence plays in these respective movements. Because critics of both the pro-life movement and the animal rights movement have argued with varying degrees of accuracy that these are extremists who are, you know, causing serious harm. And so one of the things we do, purely for the sake of argument, before we get into that, is to ask the question, well, is violence morally justified? That is to say, you know, if currently someone were doing to humans what happens routinely to non-human animals, you know, throughout the world, I think most of us would say it is morally justified, at the very least, to violate property rights and to cause some, you know, property destruction, to rescue as many humans as one can from that kind of horrible treatment and eventual death. And so if you're a serious, you know, animal activist, why not do that? You know, isn't it morally justified, even if you don't want to go to prison? And so you might want not do it for pragmatic reasons. And likewise, you could ask the same thing about, you know, an anti-abortion activist who believes abortion is morally equivalent to murder. You would, you know, you would take many steps, including, you know, physical intervention to stop someone from committing murder of a fully born living human being. And so just as a logical matter, right, it does seem like if one accepts the premises, then violence is morally justified, even if it might not be legally justified. We don't really engage with that on the anti-abortion side because we don't think that we don't accept the argument. And even with respect to sentient fetuses, we think that there are various reasons why the moral choice should rest with a pregnant person rather than with some third party or the government. But we do wrestle with it for animal activists. And the conclusion we reach is that in order to justify the use of physical force, whether it's to commit property damage or even worse, loss of human life, right? You need to not only think that the moral wrong of what's being inflicted on the animals is very, very serious, which we do think it is, but you also need to think that your act of violence is going to actually benefit those animals. And we have two reasons for thinking that's not true. One is that you know, there are just so many animals in this system, and if there is one thing that sort of unites the general public against the cause, it's acts of violence. Even property damage is very bad publicity. And so it's likely to be counterproductive to the movement. Second reason is that there are so many things one can do short of violence to rescue individual animals. That if your concern is, well, at least I've saved that one animal, you can save that one animal from using various other nonviolent methods. So at the end of the day, we come out pretty strongly against it. We also, entertain the idea that you might associate with, Gandhi or Thoreau or Martin Luther King Jr. that, violence is never an appropriate means towards achieving a sort of peaceful goal. I think that's I'm generally sympathetic to that view, but I don't think that that's the core of our argument.
That's really interesting. I have spoken many times with one of the officer of the Animal Liberation Front press office about, the actions of the Animal Liberation Front. And so I guess my question is, what do you make of acts of violence such as what they did in Iceland, where they wrecked two whaling ships, and basically put a stop to a very lucrative economic activity in Iceland? Are there some exceptions to that, some acts of violence, of property damage that could be very impactful if enacted?
Yeah, so first I'd say that, I think with a few exceptions, ALF and Sea Shepherd are less what we had in mind. We were more focused on acts of violence with respect to domestic farming. But, the argument I just laid out, right, is ultimately depends on a kind of predictive and empirical question. And right, whereas one can save a cow without breaking into a farm, harder to save the whales through some other means. So I guess I understand how one could reach a contrary conclusion with respect to free living animals in the ocean. I had in mind, I mean, one of the things that I think about sort of a group like Direct Action Everywhere or DXE, and they are very much against doing even property damage. I mean, the most kind of property damage they might do is they might cut a wire or something that prevents someone from getting to an animal, but they're not doing any kind of serious economic damage. And the defense is typically that the animals they're rescuing had, zero or even negative economic value to the farmers. And so, to my mind, the question for them is the stakes are lower because you're not causing, serious property damage. You're certainly not causing serious harm. There is, of course, always a risk that there could be violence more likely against members of your own group if there happens to be a guard there or someone. This is not activity in which I engage, so I don't know how to weigh all of those factors. But I talked to Wayne Chung after he was in prison. Wayne, of course, founder of DXE, no longer with DXE, but so still very much involved in this sort of movement. And he had said before and after he went to prison that he thought that his going to prison would be good for the movement, right? So that when we say we're against violence, we're not against civil disobedience, but it's civil disobedience in the sort of Thoreau, Gandhi, King tradition, in which part of the dramatization of the seriousness of your cause is your willingness to go to jail.
I do think it it takes a lot of creativity to go and try to see the parallels between pro-life and the animal rights movement and try to learn from other social movements that are not looked upon as being adjacent to the animal rights movement. I always hear activists talk about the animal rights movement as a social justice movement or something akin to that. But I really like the idea of getting inspired or studying at least other social movements and you know, learning from what they have accomplished. Now, we should maybe touch briefly on this topic, but the pro-life movement has been successful in the US in reaching their goals. What do you make of that success?
So I'm not sure they've been successful. They've been successful in making abortion illegal in about half the country. I don't think they've been successful in reducing the number of abortions, right? There are, there's actually evidence that the number of abortions has actually increased in the now nearly 3 years since the Supreme Court overruled a constitutional right to abortion. Part of that is because of the availability of abortion pills, whether legal availability or not, or illegal availability. Part of it is because of pushback. And one of the things you've seen in the U.S. is, I think, a shift in public opinion so that as a consequence of their success in the courts, their views have become less popular, so that when abortion has been placed on the ballot in states, even in most of the fairly conservative states, it's generally lost. And when it has won, like it did in a state like Florida, it was only because there was the threshold was a sort of supermajority threshold. So I think there's a question of how you measure success. Having said that, yes, the campaign to change the law was very effective. And I think that was partly because they were able to rally people or rally their voters around particular issues to the exclusion of other issues, right? That is, there are a lot of voters in the United States who might have a whole variety of views on a great many issues, but will only vote for a candidate if they are anti-abortion. To a lesser extent, that's true of people who are pro-choice, but there's some of that. And so I think part, and the reason I'm focusing on voters, even though the big change took place in the Supreme Court, is because the way that you got a Supreme Court that was going to overturn the abortion right was through presidential appointments, which were based on campaigns, which included abortion as one of the central issues, despite all sorts of other things going on. Now, I happen to think, putting aside my animal activism hat, I happen to think that's not healthy for a democracy to have elections turn on, you know, this one issue, which, you know, to people on both sides is an important moral issue. But there are, you know, literally hundreds of other also important issues that get sort of submerged and sort of washed out as a consequence. But I think that one thing that we could learn from that is number one is patience, right? This was a campaign over the course of about 50 years. And they were persistent, and you know, even though they had setbacks, they eventually won, at least as measured by the legal change. The other thing, I guess, is the importance of having a sort of core of passionate supporters, right? So there are people who care passionately about the animal issue, and then there's a lot of what, you know, we might call diffuse support. So I think that, you know, one of the things that would could be really effective is turning some of those diffuse supporters into passionate supporters, the sorts of people who would go out and sort of vote and make this a campaign issue. It isn't there yet. The highest profile vegan politician in the United States was in the news lately. That's United States Senator Cory Booker, who just, spoke continuously on the Senate floor for 25 hours. He is quite open about the fact that he's a vegan and it's important to him. There's a now another vegan in the U.S. Senate, Adam Schiff, and they're both important players in the Democratic Party, but it's not as though there is a kind of vegan lobby or that the vegans are a powerful voice that politicians have to take seriously. So, that's something you can build over time.
Yes, I read Matthew Scully, and he mentioned how he would never support a political candidate who was not pro-choice, pro-life rather. And yeah, I have seen that how they are one issue voters, the pro-life people. And I've looked at it a bit with envy, I have to say, putting the question of democracy aside, I wish that there was more of that in the animal rights movement. People prioritizing animals over other social issues. Because if we don't do that, then who else is going to put them forward? But so you did cover that, but I guess my other question regarding that is, should we put more the emphasis on politics instead of anything else in regard to advancing the animal rights agenda? I often talk with Liz White, who is the leader of the Animal Protection Party of Canada, and every time she comes on the show, she says, everything is political. Politicians decide everything, who lives, who dies, and how are things done in terms of, exploitation of animals. But we're not, I feel lots of animal rights activists are not very political, are not inclined to make their activism more political. Do you think we should go more in that way, get inspired by the pro-life crowd and get more political?
So where possible, sure. I don't think that that is, I mean, I think you can do that on issues where you can build coalitions with people who are not fully on board the animal rights movement. So, for example, there are a number of towns in Massachusetts now that have banned the sale of fur. There was a ballot initiative in Denver to close a lamb slaughterhouse, right? There are initiatives involving the treatment of horses. You can do things about companion animals. Given though that somewhere between 95 and 98% of the people in our countries are eating and wearing animals on a daily basis, politics and the law are not going to be a means of achieving very dramatic changes in the short run, right? Not a reason not to do it right where you can, not even a reason not to, swing for the fences, even though it's futile because you raise people's awareness. But I don't think that can be certainly the exclusive strategy. I sometimes hear people, both in the animal rights side and the environmental justice movement or environmental movement, say things like, well, these are systemic problems. They can only be addressed systemically by government and so forth. And I agree there are systemic problems, but systems are composed of individuals. And so there's no reason why you can't attack a problem both at the systemic level and at the individual level. And in fact, those things will often work complementarily.
And I should differentiate the political system in Canada versus America. In Canada, we have the hope of a proportional democratic system where parties like the Animal Protection Party can vote into MPs into the parliament. So that's something that Americans, do not have. We will never see an animal party in America doing impactful work like we see being done in the Netherlands or in New Zealand.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, I would include, the Greens in much of Europe. They're not an explicitly animal rights party, but a lot of the people who are active in the Green Party have animal rights commitments along with their environmental and other commitments. Yeah, it is a problem with district by district elections and no proportional representation, that you're not going to have representation of that. It's just a call to mind, a funny thing. So I don't know if you're familiar with the Graham Greene novel The Comedians, which is a it's a novel about basically the horrors of the Papa Doc regime in Haiti. But there's a character in the book who is referred to as the presidential candidate. And you learn that he ran for president of the United States on the Vegetarian Party platform, which of course is made up, and he's a somewhat ridiculous character, but it was hopeful to me that, oh, there was a vegetarian party, at least in fiction, once.
I mean, we're grasping for straws.
Right.
I mean, again, going back to democracy, sure, America does not have the hope of a proportional democratic system, but you have the First Amendment, which is freedom of speech, and the ALF press office could not exist in Canada, but it can exist in the US. So that's something beautiful and a big win for a great environment for activists in the animal rights space.
Yeah, I think that's right. At least as they're U.S. citizens, because increasingly people who are not citizens are being punished for their freedom of expression. I hope that turns out to be a temporary anomaly. And there are other ways in which people can be influential in politics, right? Again, you can have these coalitions with other movements. So just to give another example, so on most issues, I find myself on the other side of people who call themselves libertarians, but there is a libertarian organization in the United States called White Coat Waste, which lobbies against, very strongly against medical research and experimental laboratory research on animals. There's a federal law that requires that all new drugs be tested on animals, and this libertarian organization lobbies against it on the ground that this is a waste of money because the animal testing doesn't do any good. And it turns out that some of the people who are involved in it do actually care about the animals too. So there's an opportunity to work with a potentially more powerful constituency. So I'm all for building coalitions with groups who might not share my views on any range of issues, so long as we can make common cause on this particular one, especially when it's when it involves animals.
I guess to close this topic of politics, and why do you think that Spartacus Cory Booker is not more, pro-animal, more, outspoken about his veganism? I'm always, I find myself asking this question because if I put myself in his place, I feel like I would be the first, most you know, driven on this issue and would put all of my time at. So yeah, why do you think people like Cory Booker, you mentioned Adam Schiff, I think Bill Clinton was vegan for a long time.
Not for the animals, though.
For health reasons, I suppose.
Yes, and he was never fully vegan. It was only for health reasons.
Yeah, so why are those people, and I guess more liberal politicians, because they must know vegans in their family, in their circle of friends. Why don't we see more of them being proactive in terms of, you know, animal rights?
Right. So I think it's simply because we're a very small minority of the population, right? It's not, and we are not seen as oppressed. We're seen as annoying, right? Even though, of course, we don't want to be seen as oppressed. We want them to see the oppression of the animals. It's just a matter of what's politically possible. So I think Cory Booker is actually pretty good about speaking up compared to what the possibilities are. You know, New Jersey, which is the state he represents, includes a lot of dairy farmers. So there are industries that would oppose him if he made his veganism more of a voting issue. I think notwithstanding that, he does typically come out what I regard as the right way whenever one of these issues comes up. But you're absolutely right. He's not out there pushing for, you know, a ban on, you know, animal slaughter or dairy or anything like that. And I think that reflects a kind of political reality. I just don't think it's realistic to expect somebody who has to stand for re-election to be proposing laws that are going to ensure that they don't get re-elected. So, you know, that's, again, it's simply to my mind, a numbers game. But again, you can make progress on smaller issues where you can form coalitions with people who have much less ambitious goals.
Yeah, an argument for putting limits to mandates, political mandates. Okay, I guess my last question for you, and thank you so much for your time. We went over time.
It's okay.
Is, you know, you finished a book by mentioning a book I did not get to read yet called Zootopia, and you describe what it would be like to have, you know, more of an ideal world for animal and human relationships. And I guess that's one of the best, if not the best, description of a world where the animal rights movement succeeds that I have read, you know, what it looks like if we succeed. So I would love if you could maybe as parting words to talk about that, about a Zootopia.
Sure. So that's a book by Will Kimlicka and Sue Donaldson, and they're Canadians, by the way. I think they're at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. And we actually presented a version of that chapter there before we published the book. After the book, there was a nice panel on it that Peter Singer hosted at Princeton. But that issue didn't come up. So giving credit to Will and Sue, what they say in their book is they imagine sort of three categories of animals, what they call sort of sovereigns. And these are free living wild animals, and there the idea is to just let them be. Denizens, who are animals who live among us but are not really part of our society. So think about like rats and pigeons and so forth. And then citizens. And the idea that I find most intriguing is the idea of citizens. So these are, you know, these are basically the most domesticated animals. Think of dogs, sheep, etc., with whom they imagine have a kind of mutualist relationship. I want to think that's possible. And I think, I mean, I live with three dogs. I think on our good days, we have a mutualist relationship. If I'm If I'm playing frisbee with one of my dogs, I throw the frisbee and he's clearly enjoying going after it, and occasionally catching it, usually picking it up after it lands. And then, bouncing back to me with the frisbee. He's enjoying it and I'm enjoying it. And that is, I think, characteristic of a good deal of our relationship. You see anybody who's lives with a affectionate companion animal, they lie on their back to get a belly rub or something like that. That's a sort of mutually satisfactory relationship. I think that's possible, but I also think it's fraught, right? That is to say, even for our most beloved animals, we are controlling their lives in ways that I think are suboptimal. I would be very sad if that were to stop being the case. I don't think there's any risk of it stopping. I mean, I adopted all my dogs from shelters. I'd continue to do that. But in an ideal world, people aren't breeding these animals. What Will and Sue say is, well, they would breed on their own and there'd be these animals, and they would come in. And so, maybe. I think it might look a little bit like the relationship between humans and the first dogs, which were sort of friendly wolves that came around the campfire of their own accord. I do think, though, that the kind of ideal future is also going to have to include just a lot more wild spaces that humans don't enter, right? And so an enormous reduction in the consumption of animal products will facilitate that because it will mean we just need much less land to grow food. That is also facilitated by the decline in human population, which is likely to begin in 20 years or so, right? That is, birth rates worldwide are declining almost everywhere. We will eventually reach a point of population decline, and then presumably at some point, stability at a much lower level where it's possible for there to be these wild spaces, assuming we get there before, the complete ecological disaster. And so I think the relationship that the ideal relationship I'm imagining is one in which, for the most part, we just leave the animals alone. But I would like to think that there will be these citizens or perhaps denizens with whom we have friendly relations. But I doubt I'm going to see any of that in my lifetime. So right now, my main goal is just to sort of minimize the harm.
Wonderful. Mike, thank you so much. Thank you for your work. I really consider your book as a classic of
Thank you.
animal rights books, and it's really up there in my list. So thank you for the book. Thank you for your activism and your work in the space of animal rights. And a big thank you for having taken the time to answer my questions.
It was my pleasure. This was really a fun conversation.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.